We're back. Yes, we are. And it's the second part of today's It's All About Food show. Thank you again for joining me, for being there. It means a lot to me that you're there. And my next guest is Mark Hawthorne. He is an activist and author of 3 books on animal rights and social justice, A Vegan Ethic, Embracing a Life of Compassion Toward All, Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering, and Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism, which empowers people around the world to get active for animals. He stopped eating meat after an encounter with one of India's many cows in 1992 and became an ethical vegan a decade later. He blogs about activism at markhawthorne.com, and you'll find him tweeting at Mark Hawthorne. Hi, Mark. I'm happy you're here to join me today.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Well, you know, we spoke a few years ago when you wrote your last book, Bleeding Hearts.
Yes, I remember. That was one of the highlights of my year. Thank you very much.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I love this program that I've been doing for 7.5 years now. And I get to speak to many wonderful people, including yourself and including your partner, Lauren Ornelas, and learning about all of the great activism that's going on around the world. And, you know, we can choose to focus on whatever we want to focus on. And many people have CNN on all day long and choose to hear different sensational stories and listening to political opinions or whatever, or we can tune into something completely different and make a powerful, positive change for ourselves and feel better about it and also make a great impact on the world. So I choose to listen and I choose to read books like something you just wrote, A Vegan Ethic. Thanks for writing that book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was. I think it helps fill a gap out there. For some vegans and for people who want to go vegan. And so it was a great pleasure to write after writing a book on animal exploitation and writing a how-to guide to animal activism. You know, I really wanted to write a book that was not only a guide to going vegan and a brief introduction to animal rights, but also a book that explored, you know, the connections that different oppressions, including speciesism, share, and also to interview and talk about some of the amazing activists in the world who are not only working on behalf of animals, but working on behalf of oppressed humans.
You use the word pleasure, and I just find that an interesting word because, I want you to enjoy everything that you do, and in writing, I hope you get pleasure out of writing. But the things that you write about are not easy topics. And the things that you bring out to all of us are not easy things to acknowledge within ourselves. How do you do that?
Well, Bleeding Hearts, the second book, the one that you and I talked about a few years ago, was probably the most difficult because I was examining issues that are just so difficult to address, not only because of the cruelty that the animals suffer, but the fact that humans are the ones inflicting this pain and suffering, and it sometimes can make us feel ashamed to be human. So with that book, one of the ways that I made it easier, not only for myself but for the reader, is to talk about solutions and each chapter with ways that we can make a difference, ways that we can change. And that's the same with this book. Now, this book, A Vegan Ethic, is much lighter. It doesn't delve into the nitty-gritty of animal exploitation that Bleeding Hearts does. It's more of an overview. But it also talks about solutions. As I mentioned before, I talked to activists from, you know, various walks of life and various social justice issues, people like Patrice Jones at Find Sanctuary and Breeze Harper at Just a Vegan Project, my partner, you mentioned Lauren Ornelas of Food Empowerment Project. And I got their insights on into how they make a difference in the world, how they take all the abuse that is inflicted not only upon non-human animals, but also human animals, and how they are agents of change. And I think that's very hopeful. And so I think that the message for the reader is much more pleasurable. And you close the book, which is, it's only 180 or so pages. You can easily read it on a flight across country. You close the book thinking, yeah, there's a lot going out there, a lot of pain and suffering, but I can make a difference. The first step is to go vegan, but beyond that, there's a lot of other things we can do.
There are so many things that we can do. And this book is really a great overview of all the so many things that are wrong with the world and then the things that we can do about it.
Yeah.
I wanted to touch on just a few things that you talked about in the book. Like, for example, you mentioned circuses, and I was surprised recently because I was familiar with the fact that Ringling Brothers had agreed to stop using elephants, I think by 2017 or 2018. I don't even know what year. But I didn't realize that they're still going to be using other animals.
Yeah, the Ringling Brothers is a tricky situation to discuss. They did promise to stop using elephants in their performances by, I think it was next year. They actually supposedly ended that practice early. I think it was in May of this year. However, my understanding is that those elephants are going to their quote-unquote retirement center in Florida, and there's some question as to what extent those animals will still be exploited. Mm-hmm. I've read that they're going to be used for cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
They still may be used for breeding for zoos. So that's the first part of the answer to your question. The second part is, yeah, they definitely use other animals. I think that the focus has been on elephants for a number of years because they are these very charismatic animals, and there's the use of the bull hook that has been in the news a lot lately, which is this metal device that looks kind of like a fireplace poker. It's got a very sharp end on one side, and these people, that they call themselves trainers or handlers in the zoo, use these instruments to prod the elephant in very sensitive parts of their anatomy to make them behave in ways that they want to be, that the zoo or the circus want them to behave. And so, when this news has come to light and activists have brought this to the public's attention, there was a big outcry, and a lot of cities are even banning the use of bullhooks as a way to eliminate circuses in their cities. But, yeah, we still have a lot of work to do. We still need to get them to not use any animals in their performances.
Well, one of the great misfortunes is that elephants are kind of a throwback to the dinosaur age, these great big animals, and they're near extinction. So that may solve the problem with using elephants in circuses if we don't have any more, unfortunately, but I hope that doesn't happen.
Conservationists have predicted that we could lose elephants altogether within 20 years. A couple of years ago, they reached a tipping point in the world where there are now more elephants being killed than are being born. They're being killed mainly for their tusks, for ivory. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Karen. We could see the last of elephants in our lifetime, which is extremely distressing.
Okay, switching subjects, you clearly make a great effort to bring us all together, connect the dots, have us align on issues, and look at everything from a compassionate point of view. And I wanted to bring up a couple of things. So one of the things you bring up in your book is about some of the very unfortunate people who work in these abattoirs, these slaughterhouses, and how we've had some undercover videos come out by vegan organizations, animal rights organizations that are trying to fight what's going on in factory farming and in slaughterhouses, and they're filthy and they're horrific. And even though we may have some regulations, they don't even follow the few regulations that are out there. And these undercover videos come along and show some unfortunate human beings who are treating the animals on the way to slaughter just horrifically. And we focus our negative energy on those poor human beings. And you brought out some really important issues in your book on that subject.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning slaughterhouse workers. You know, let me start off by saying that I'm not in any way saying that I think that these workers are heroes, or that that I am blind to the fact that they're killing animals every day. But I also want to point out that these people are, for the most part, economic refugees. They come into the United States without any hope of a good life. And, you know, they don't grow up thinking, gee, I want to be a slaughterhouse worker when I become an adult. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are people who are mistreated themselves. They suffer a lot of psychological damage. They suffer physical damage. And that starts at the top. You know, it's how these workers are treated. And they, in turn, mistreat the animals. So when a group comes in and does an undercover investigation, they're not really capturing the full story. You know, they're capturing a few moments of suffering that rightly should be brought to light. I completely agree that what happens in slaughterhouses is abhorrent. But by targeting these people, they're really furthering the oppression of these groups. They're mainly people of color, and often they're simply deported. So what happens is that the owners of the slaughterhouses and the managers working there get off scot-free. You know, there's no accountability for them. And so I in some ways I think we're going after the wrong people here. You know,
yeah.
We're also overlooking the fact that most of us contribute to this cruelty by eating animal products, most of us being, you know, people outside the vegan community. So I think that's an important thing to recognize as well.
Yeah, it's very misguided. I've read a number of books on factory farming and how they talk about the people in the community who are frustrated because they don't have good jobs anymore, and there's all kinds of problems in their town, and all these immigrants have come in and are working in the factory farms, and they're blaming the immigrants. But it's such a bigger, deeper story. And the people in the community don't realize, the ones who have been there originally, don't realize how much they have contributed to the problem that has been created. It's really hard to see the big picture.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
I wanted to know your opinion. Are you familiar with the Liberation Pledge?
I'm familiar with a few pledges. I'm not sure if they...
I just saw this one online, and I'm smiling talking about it, but I'm not sure what I think about it. There's a pledge that's going around. It's called Liberation Pledge. It's at liberationpledge.com. I think you can get a little bracelet that says Liberation Pledge,
yeah.
And it looks like a fork.
I'm familiar with this, yes.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be to publicly refuse to eat animals. Okay, I'm cool with that. Publicly refuse to sit where people are eating animals and encourage others to take the pledge. And I'm kind of I'm at odds with publicly refusing to sit where people are eating animals. And I thought maybe we could have a little conversation about that. You don't talk directly about that in your book, but I think you take a very compassionate stance about people and where they are on the food continuum and how we should all engage with each other. So I'm thinking that this is an interesting pledge. And
yeah.
Does it have value, or is it, I don't know. I'll give you an example. When I was about 20 years ago, I was living in France, and then I came back to New York, and that meant that I was near my immediate family, my parents and my brother's family, and we would have Thanksgiving together. And I said, look, I'm a vegan, and I would love to have Thanksgiving with you, but I can't have Thanksgiving if there's going to be a dead bird on the table. And I made a kind of ultimatum. Now, I only did that because it was my parents, and I had the kind of relationship that I knew I could do that with them. And they were wonderful, and they said, fine, no dead bird on the table. We made all vegan dishes. It was beautiful. When my brother got married and more people came into the picture, it became a very different story. And I could not, quote, control those other people. And nor did I want to. So I ended up compromising and joining in many Thanksgivings. They all agreed not to put the bird on the table. They kept it in the kitchen, but there was meat served. And I just thought it was more important to be inclusive with my family than, you know, be militant about my choice.
Yeah, I agree with your point of view. I don't think that there's much traction that we can gain as activists by refusing to associate with people who are animal exploiters. And I realize I'm taking this pledge idea beyond the step that the bracelet and website represent. But, you know, we all, for the most of us, we all grew up eating animals. And to tell somebody I'm no longer going to dine with you if you're going to consume animals, or to refuse to be in a room or at a table with people who are eating animals, you know, I think we miss a good opportunity for activism. I was at a lunch function one time where I was at a table with about 12 people, a big round table, and I had informed the hotel the day before or 2 days before that I was vegan and I wouldn't be eating the chicken that they were going to be serving. And everybody was served this chicken, and, you know, I got the roasted vegetables, which are sort of the de facto version of the vegan lunch. Fortunately, it's gotten better in the last couple of years. But anyway, everybody asked me why I didn't eat chicken or why I wasn't eating animals, and it gave me the opportunity to explain how chickens are raised, and politely tell them why I was vegan. And obviously it made some people uncomfortable, but I think that over a period of time, you can plant seeds that way.
Absolutely.
Whether it's at a family gathering or you're with your coworkers at lunch. But, you know, denying that opportunity, you're not going to advance the vegan cause by only eating with other vegans. That's my opinion of it.
Good. I just saw it like a couple of days ago, so I thought, I'll talk to somebody about it. And I thought you were a good person to bring it up with.
Yes. Now, Karen, let me just add, too, that I've spoken about this pledge with a few, more than a few other vegans, and we're all aligned in our thinking that it's kind of not the best idea.
Okay, good. Back to your book. One of the things that I really liked was the frequently asked questions. And I've found being a vegan for almost 30 years anyway, some of the questions remain the same. And then there's many more questions that keep adding to the pool of questions you ask vegans. People keep hitting the boundaries and finding new questions. You know, why do this or why do that? And so these answers are really great. And it just fascinates me how people will dig and try and find a reason not to change hard as they can.
I think people are by and large creatures of habit, and we can also be very lazy. And so change is difficult for us.
Well, I think it was the second question in your frequently asked question list. I'm not sure which one it was, but it was what happens to all the animals when people stop eating them?
Right.
And what blew my mind was when I spoke to 250 cattle producers the night before a bull sale at an event I was invited to talk about climate change. And these people asked me that question. And these are the people that are artificially inseminating their animals and know how right. they're creating the hundreds yeah. and thousands that they're raising. And yet they still asked, what would happen?
Yeah. Yeah, talk about being in denial. I mean, that's just and to think that they are the ones responsible for the suffering, not only the suffering, but bringing these poor animals into creation, so to speak, for a few weeks or a couple of months, and then slaughtering them, and then asking, well, "Gee, if we didn't keep doing this, what would happen to them?" That's laughable.
I'm going to sum up a little of what I got from you and your book, broad strokes here, and that is, we are not perfect, and we cannot reach necessarily an ideal, but we can all do the best we can, and we could make tremendous improvement. We may kill a few insects along the way. There may be some damage done, but when we're mindful and conscious and making intelligent choices, we can do a lot of good on the planet.
I think that's a perfect way to sum it up, and I love that you started off by saying we're not perfect, and that's one of the messages I'm trying to get across with this book. And in fact, I emphasize there's a section there called Practice Makes Progress, in which I say that practice might be the way to get to perfection if you're trying to learn a language or if you're trying to learn a musical instrument, but not necessary for being vegan. Being vegan is not about perfection. So just trying every day to do your best. It's just using progress as your guide, and trying new recipes, and just being aware. And being aware for me means being aware of my privilege, and that's another message of the book. I grew up with a lot of privilege, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to acknowledge. And there are white males who have the sort of privilege that I have grown up with and maintain in my life. I think need to be aware of that too, and be conscious of our fellow beings, our fellow humans and animals, and try to just be compassionate. And that sounds so trite, but it's really, for some people can take an effort. You really have to consciously think about it. You have to make an effort every day to acknowledge the other person and to recognize that in many cases they don't have the same privilege that a lot of other people do. Even having the internet is a privilege. Being able to read is a privilege. Being able to shop for healthy food in your neighborhood is a privilege. So there's so many things that we don't consider that I'm trying to bring to light here, trying to remind us of.
Absolutely. Okay, so we just have a few minutes left. I was going to ask you right in the beginning of the program a couple of things, and you jumped right in and answered one of them right away to some degree, which is, who did you write this book for? Maybe we could sum that up again. And the other question is, where do you want this book to go? Who's it for, and where would you like it to go? Other than the bestseller of the New York Times list.
Well, that goes without saying. It's written for new vegans or people who want to go vegan. It's written for longtime activists who are interested in social justice. And it's written for people who are vegan and have been vegan for a long time but haven't been able maybe to explain to their family and friends in a succinct way why they're vegan. So because it's short and it's not graphic, it's an easy book to have on your shelf and maybe lend to your parents or to your friends or coworkers and say, hey, if you spend a couple hours reading this, it'll really answer a lot of questions as to why I'm vegan. and maybe inspire in those people a desire to learn more and to maybe think about other social justice issues as well. And as far as where I'd like the book to go, I'd really like it to be a launching point for discussion. I'm getting interest from a lot of readers who want to use it in their schools. They want to have it mm-hmm. in their school libraries, and even from professors who might want to include it in their curriculum for the year. And so I really want it to be a discussion point. You know, I'm not an expert in some of these social justice issues, which is why I spotlight a lot of these activists who have been devoted their lives to it.
So I'm glad you brought that up. We have about 30 seconds. And I was going to say, before you mentioned these people saying they wanted to use it in their schools, I think it would make a great textbook, high school and college. And because you didn't go into detail in so many of the discussions that you brought up, that would enable people who are interested in one thing or another to dig deeper and do some research and report. It would just make a great learning tool. But Mark, thank you. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. I feel honored to be able to read what you've written and talk with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for having me back on your show. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Mark Hawthorne, the author of A Vegan Ethic. All right. We've come to an end of another It's All About Food show. Thank you so much for joining me. You can find me at info@realmeals.org. If you have any questions and comments, I always love to hear from you. And visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where I have my daily What Vegans Eat blog, now in 560 posts. And remember, have a delicious week, okay? Bye-bye.